Chapter 34. Grand Admiral Ray Sloan once ran away from home. She did this because her family was not wealthy, and because her world, Ganthel, was a way station to other worlds, richer worlds, greener worlds. So she did as many children wish to do, and some even accomplish. She escaped out her window while her parents slept, and made her way to the nearest ship dock in the hope of sneaking on board a freighter and traveling the galaxy. She, also as many children do, chickened out. But before she did, young Ray Sloan made it all the way to the ship dock, hiding between two crates of Corellium scheduled for shipment off-world. It was there, she decided, that this whole running away thing was not really in her blood. And as she turned to go home, she found her escape from between the two containers blocked by a pair of thugs from a local gang, the Kataska. Spicers and slavers who wore metal masks cut into the shapes of skulls. The two men chuckled behind their skull plates and came for her. She ran the other way and found that way blocked by two more of the Kataska gang. Sloan had no way out. They grabbed her and put a bag over her head. It was then she knew she was a goner. She would not run away. Rather, she would be stolen, abducted and carried off, not to adventure or wealth, but to a life of toil, and most likely horror. Thankfully, a nearby astromech saw what was happening and set himself off as an alarm. Sirens and strobing lights that summoned the nearest dock constable to chase off the Kataska. She was free, and the moment her heels hit steel, she bolted home. Her parents never found out. Later, the Empire would come to Ganthel and clear out the scum on her world. That was when she first began to regard Imperial control as a heroic, necessary presence in an otherwise chaotic galaxy. Right now, as her command shuttle descends out of lightspeed, she feels the same feeling she felt then, when caught between those crates. I've no way out. I'm trapped. I need to run. Ahead sits the beautiful blue-green world of Chandrilla. A world she fears suddenly will become her pretty, pretty tomb. Chandrilla is ringed by New Republic ships. Ships born of the allegiance of worlds. Mon Cala cruisers, old Alderaanian frigates, Sullustan ring ships, not to mention a trio of new battleships, Nadiri Starhawks. All these are craft representative of worlds spurned by the Empire. The people on board those ships hate her. She has no preternatural sense for it. Sloan does not possess the Force. She cannot feel the hate coming off them in waves. It is simply an estimate that they hate her. But why wouldn't they? She represents the blunt, brute fist of the Empire they despise. Their greatest desire, she imagines, would be to cut that fist off and leave it cooling on the floor at their feet. They hate her, and she does not know why their first response is not to immediately fire upon her with all their weapons. For this reason, she already has her hyperspace drive sending fresh calculations back to the Ravager. The shuttle's pilot, Ensign Damascus, says, "They are sending escorts. Stand by." Ahead, a quadrangle formation of starfighters, Y-wings, descends upon her.
"Here they come," she thinks. "Weapons hot."
But they never fire. Instead, they do as the pilot suggests. They escort her down to the surface of Chandrilla for peace talks. Or at least, the illusion of them. Out the window of her apartment, Nora spies the ships streaking across the powder-blue sky above Hana City. An Imperial shuttle sits alone in the midst of four Y-wings. Sloan is on that ship. Last she saw of Admiral Sloan, Nora was chasing Sloan's shuttle in a stolen TIE fighter. The TIE's cannons thinned the shuttle's shields until she scored a vital direct hit, and then the shuttle detonated, catching Nora in the explosion. She survived that, to her surprise. Apparently Sloane did too. It takes a surprising amount of sheer will not to go darting out of her apartment and into the cockpit of whatever ship she can find to finish the job she began there in orbit above Akiva. Take down Sloane. And yet, she doesn't. Instead, she quakes and she shimmers, and she wills herself to look away from the window and again at herself in the floor-length mirror. Her standing there in her naval dress uniform. She didn't even know the New Republic had naval dress. This is a uniform that echoes her old pilot flight suit, but in a formal way. It's stiff and itchy. She hates how she looks in it. She tried to tell them, "I'm not even with the New Republic anymore. I renounce that." And they told her that would be a conversation for later. She received a handwritten invitation from the Chancellor herself to come on stage with Brenton and Temin. That, in order to herald the celebration of Liberation Day, with her as one of the liberators, married to one of the liberated. The Chancellor's note said at the bottom,
"Yours is a crucial narrative, Nora Wexley. One we must tell to ourselves and to the Empire. We are lucky to have you. Will you join us?"
Now, if only she actually had her son and her husband with her, maybe she could do what the Chancellor wanted. But they're nowhere to be... Behind her, the door to the room slides open. There stands Brenton. The light of the morning meets him through the window, and the doorway frames him in just such a way. For a moment, he's her Brenton again. Boyish cheeks and wise eyes... A wry twist to his face, hands stuffed in his pockets.
"Hey,"
she says, her voice quieter than she means. "Hey," he says. Then a cloud passes in front of the sun, and a shadow moves into the room. And then he's gone. Returned is the Brenton of now. He's thinner. His eyes are set back more, and that wry twist becomes a dark line. "I'm late," he says.
And he is. "Yes, you are. So is your son. Have you seen him?"
Brenton twitches at that.
A fog seems to fall upon him.
No. She has no time to try to shine a light through that muddle. And even if she did have the time, it might not matter. Brenton sometimes seems like he's dozens of parsecs away. Like he's still in that prison pod. All she can do now is lay out his clothes. A simple formal white suit given to her by the Chancellor's people. And help him get into it. He seems to brighten for a moment. "I'm sure Temin will join us."
"At the last minute, no doubt."
"He's so much older now," Brenton says as she hands him a pair of shined brown boots. As he buckles the tops, he adds, "I regret missing all of that. Him growing up. You joining the rebellion in my stead. Gods, the rebellion isn't even a thing anymore." Then he looks up at her from the bed, and his eyes are clear and bright, but lined with trouble when he says, "I love you, and I'm sorry I missed all of it.
Are we okay?" She's frozen.
Her mouth opens, but no sound comes out of her.
All this time, she's been waiting for a moment just like this one. Some tiny glimmer of who he was. Some semblance of recognition regarding what came and then passed. And now, here it is, laid out before her, as if on a serving tray. And all she can do is stare at it and gape.
Her heart feels like an animal in a net. Her vision clouds from behind tears. She quickly blinks away.
Then it all snaps into focus. They're going to be okay.
She tells him as much, stroking his cheek.
"We're going to be okay. We may not be now, but that's okay. Because we'll get there. All of us."
He offers a small smile and nods. "Okay.
I believe you. Nora stoops to kiss her husband. He's shaking just a little.
Or maybe it's her shaking. Or both of them.
The kiss is soft and slow.
It isn't one of the romantic, passionate kisses of their youth, stolen under one of the market tents as rain pounded the ground and everyone huddled there to stay dry.
It is a wiser, stranger, altogether more hesitant kiss. But it's all the sweeter, too.
We have to go soon,
she says, kissing him again, this time more quickly. Just a peck. I'm sure Temin will meet us there, he says, repeating himself from before.
Almost mechanically so.
Nora flinches at it, but it's probably nothing.
She clutches his hand, gives it a squeeze.
It would surprise me if he didn't.
Temin kicks out again. His feet slam against the inside of the box. The crate rattles, and the frame shakes, but the box is made of some kind of heavy compressed wood. Ugh, it's not budging. And it doesn't help that his whole body feels like it's been worked over by a drunken basilisk boxer. Forearms punching him like he's just some sack of Qadari rice. That stun blast hit him hard, left him hurting. My father shot me. What does that even mean? Why would he do that? Temin stays still, snaps his fingers idly as he tries to imagine why Brenton would do that to him. Maybe, just maybe, Dad did it because he was trying to protect his son. He didn't kill Temin, after all. Maybe he knows something. Maybe he did a bad thing in service of a good thing. Or maybe it's not his father at all. Could it be someone else? Someone masquerading as Brenton Wexley?
Temin almost hopes that's the case. It would make this easier.
Again, he growls and renews his struggle against the box. The box shakes and shifts, but it's no good. Something's wrong. Something's going on. Something
is shaking.
Beneath him, a faint vibration rises.
Someone is coming.
Hey! He shouts, slamming his heel against the underside of the box's magna-sealed lid. Hey! I'm in here! Help! Help!
No more sounds. Quiet stretches out. And then he hears a weapon warming up.
The slow thrum to power. The box shakes, and sparks rain down on him. Temin screams, covering his eyes with his forearm, scrunching up into himself as the top of the box is burned through with a bright vibroblade and flung aside.
I have discovered you,
comes the mechanized warble of Mr. Bones.
This was the longest and most protracted game of hide-and-seek, Master Temin. But again, I am the victor. Shall we play again?
Temin springs up out of the box and hugs his skeletal droid.
It is so good to see you, Bones.
It is good to see you happy.
I'm not happy. My father shot me.
That is unfortunate, Master Temin. I will scatter his atoms in return.
Not yet. First things first. We need to get to Mom.
Roger, roger. We will find Master Temin's mom.
She needs to know that something is going on. And I don't know what it is.
But Temin aims to find out. The door to the shuttle remains closed.
Sloane needs a moment.
Behind her, she has four of her own people. And that's it. She has two royal guards. Neither were Palpatine's original guards. But the menacing red cloaks and hood helmets remain the same. She has the pilot, Ensign Kars Damascus, and she has her own attaché, Adia Wright. Trusted, necessary Adia. So trusted and so necessary that Sloane almost didn't want her to come. Just in case. Even now, she says to Adia,
This could be a setup.
I don't believe that it is,
Adia answers.
Rax could be testing us.
Rax is always testing. So let's pass his test.
Sloane scowls.
He may have sent us here to fail.
What sense would that make? Then you would just tell the New Republic who he was. You could give up Imperial assets. Him putting you in their hands would be foolish if he believed this to be a danger.
She's right, of course. Sloane knows this. She's thought this out. Just the same, she fears what will happen. The tendons in her neck are pulled taut as a tow cable. Something isn't right. None of this is right.
You're just afraid. You're that girl again on Ganthal, surrounded by enemies. Don't run this time, Rey. This is the time to stand and fight.
They might just take us into custody soon as we step off this shuttle,
she says to Adia. The girl nods. Her eyes show a glimmer of fear at that, too.
They might. But Admiral Rax believes them to be foolishly optimistic enough not to. Let us trust in his assessment just this once.
Yes. What choice do they have, anyway?
To the pilot, Sloane says,
open the door!
Lower the ramp.
And he does. The door lifts. The ramp descends in twin plumes of steam, like the breath from a rancor's nostrils. The brightness of the day reaches her eyes, and she winces against it, shielding her face as she steps off. She expects a flurry of movement. Guards coming for her, blasters up, staves crossing. But instead, she steps forward and is met by Chancellor Mon Mothma. A tall woman with a wine-stem neck and hair the color of copperstone. The Chancellor dips her head.
Admiral Sloane, thank you for this.
Chancellor.
She'll give that woman no more than that. Behind Mothma is the rank and file. Soldiers, guards, and of course various New Republic generals and admirals. Akbar isn't here, to her surprise. Nor is the Alderaanian traitor, Leia Organa. She wonders why. Then it hits her. They aren't here just in case this is a trap. If this shuttle were rigged to explode, then certainly... Her chest tightens.
What if it is rigged?
It would take out the Chancellor and a wave of soldiers and officers.
And her.
It would be what Rax wanted all along.
It could be... No, that's absurd.
She had the shuttle checked. And surely they did prelim scans before they let her land, too, looking for any kind of explosive residue or unusual chemical signatures.
We have quite a day planned,
the Chancellor says, jostling Sloane out of her grim reverie.
We have a celebration ongoing. And then, at dinner time, you and I will retire to begin our talks.
Sloane braces.
I did not come here to have a party, Chancellor. I would prefer to move straight to business.
Your attaché said your presence here deserved pomp and circumstance, as is the way of one sovereign entity greeting another.
Sloane shoots Adia a look. The girl made a mistake, and she will be chastised for it. Now, however, is not the time. Instead, Sloane turns, forces a smile.
Yes, perhaps she is right. We are all owed a moment of leisure. Thank you for hosting these talks, Chancellor. Shall we begin?